that we all have common ancestors. In other words,
are you talking about Ernst Haeckel's
embryos, yeah, which were, you know, at the time in the 1880s and 1890s were already, through his colleagues, shown to be fraudulent, but they're still printed in books to this day. That's a travesty. That's just a kind of a shocking overturning of normal teaching integrity. But let's leave that to one side. The embryos are supposed to show common ancestry. And the earlier you get into the process, the closer the embryos should be in how they form. But it was revealed in the last several decades that the embryos of even closely related, supposedly closely related, vertebrate, for example, the vertebrate embryos comparing a turtle, a frog, a chick, you know, a pig, and a human, the way that the embryos form in its earliest stages are radically different. For about, you know, a third of the development of the embryo, the radically different pathway. Then for about a third of the development of that embryo, the embryos do look a little bit similar, but there's still noticeable difference. If you're an embryologist, you can instantly spot what embryo you're looking at. And then they radically diverge again as they get closer to the birth, or to hatching or whatever. And as you look at the history of embryology, you find that the key embryologists who used to say that the similarity of embryos is evidence for evolution, now they're saying that the absolute dissimilarity of embryos at their earliest stage is a gigantic mystery. And all we have to say is that somehow evolution had the ability to tweak the early pathways without messing things up. Well, that goes against the pronouncements that we've read in the literature over and over, that the earlier on you get in the embryonic process, the more conserved, that is, the less deviation you can have. And so the discovery of the radical divergence, the radical difference in the very earliest stages of embryos is a huge embarrassment, a huge mystery for evolution.
Do you ever notice, though, I mean, I got this from reading all the scientific literature, is they keep imputing design into evolution. In other words, they keep imputing a form of intelligence, even though you can't say that because nobody wants to believe that. They keep talking about it as if that were it.
Well, they would say it's just almost hallucinogenic, and I mean, it's apparent design. It's like an illusion. It's not real.
And my daughter and I call it another, usually we'll look at each other and say, oh, it's another triumph of random chance.
Right, exactly.
Where do you think this is going now? In other words, we're running short on time, and I had made a comment the other day, you know, there's all this fight over whether or not we should even just teach the controversy in school. In other words, there's an effort to keep that out. And I said, you know, you really don't have to force this whole controversy into schools. All you have to do is arm the students with the information when they go to schools.
Yeah.
And that will be sowing enough doubt right at the outset.
Yeah.
And indeed, Professor Miller's comments are showing that to a certain degree that's precisely what's happening right now.
Yes. And I would say his comment that the work of intelligent design is discouraging students from going into science, I would say that's exactly opposite. I'm very delighted you played that. I may be able to use that in my next book, which I'm writing, the kind of the next phase, the following on my book, Doubts About Darwin. But I would say that where it's going is, if we're going to see in the next 2 to 3 years, a ratcheting up further and further, and we will see gigantic, catastrophic, structural collapses of major defenders, and major arguments of the Darwinian theory will become crashing down in front of us. And I think that the first series of problems is going to be in comparing the genomes, the packages of DNA possessed by even bacteria. In the last 2 months, they've found that DNA possessed by humble bacteria often do not even resemble each other more than 60-70%. In other words, each of these five major kinds of bacteria that they completed reading out the DNA, each of them have one-third unique genes just to that species of bacteria. Well, that is so foundational, amazing, shocking to the theory that all these things, these little DNA snippets, are just being written steadily, slowly, at random. The idea that they could have such drastically different genomes, one from another, is just it's in no way a prediction of the theory. The other thing is that they found the junk DNA. They thought the Darwinists were saying was left over kind of proof of evolution that we have all this unused DNA. Well, the discovery recently that the junk DNA is not so junky, it actually has a function. That was a prediction that came out of the intelligent design movement years ago. And it was not written up so always, but many of our scientists were saying, we believe that we will eventually find function. And guess what? Now, finally, they're finding the function of what they thought originally was useless leftover DNA, the kind of the proof of evolution. Now, it's very, very important and not so junky. So I think that we're going to see an implosion. I would give it 2 years, maybe three at the most, and we will see many of the key Darwinists will say, they will not necessarily sign on to intelligent design, but they will say the theory has deep structural problems and we need to look for a new theory.
But that would be a candid admission in the first place, I guess.
It would, and it would be a huge opening for the just discussion to begin at the highest levels. The level of rhetoric, the heat of the rhetoric from the Darwinists just can't get much worse. I mean, if it gets much worse, they'll take to the streets and start attacking us, you know. It's almost that bad. But I don't want to discourage anybody. If there's any wonderful time to jump in and study the sciences, especially biology, now is the time. And I can say, and as a parting shot, if there's one thing I can encourage everybody who listens to this broadcast to do without fail, and that is get a copy of this fabulous documentary on intelligent design, which is causing by itself a minor revolution, and it's called Unlocking the Mystery of Life. It's already been translated into 11 languages, and I believe it alone could overturn the Darwinian paradigm in the next 2 or 3 years.
Chris, what you're describing is very characteristic of historic changes in major paradigms through cultures. First, there's sort of a ridicule going on in which it's poo-pooed.
Mm-hmm.
As the opposition begins to gain steam, the people of the leading paradigm that are defending it panic. And then it gets more and more and...
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains, majesty above the...
Good evening and welcome to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio program. I am Roy Avila, and without Michael Shaw tonight, he's traveling around the country doing Freedom 21 business, and we're happy to be sitting in here with him. Without him tonight, we miss him, but we're going to have a great show for you, as always. First, let us tell you the number, if you choose to participate in this discussion, is 1-888-245-4237. So you can call your friends or email them, because while you're near your computer, as many of us do, we listen to the radio and be on the computer at the same time, you can get us on the World Wide Web at F21, S like Sam, C like Carol, .net. And you can click right through and it'll come out on your computer, and then you can also email your friends and tell them about this show, because for me, this has been a very interesting experience. Every week I come here, I learn. It's like going to school for free. Tonight's guests, our first guest will be Jeannie Soderman. She's going to explain how the World Bank water policy ties in with your and my local integrated water plan. We'll find out what that's about. After that, we'll hear from Logan Darrow Clements. He's the man behind Lost Liberty Hotel. It's a project using the flawed logic of the court in the Kelo versus New London decision on those justices who voted for it. In the second hour, we're going to talk about smart growth, if I can get my mouth to work. Smart growth and new urbanism parallels the Russian-Soviet planning. This will be fascinating. You will find out how, since the 1960s, planning has been going on. And you will hear from Joanne Nathan on how what they were talking about in the 1960s is actually happening right now. But first up, We have Jeannie Soderman on the line. Jeannie, how are you this evening?
Well, I'm just dandy. How are you, Roy?
I'm very excited. Every time I talk to you, the time goes really fast.
Yes, and I have only 30 minutes this evening.
And so let's get right to it. First, for people who might be, you know, how people listen to the radio, they're flipping around, all of a sudden they stop. World Bank water policy. First, for someone who might not be familiar with what the World Bank is, tell us just a bit about them.
Well, let me just start, for people that don't know me, I do research a lot for Radio Liberty, for other organizations also. But I used to be a member of World Wildlife, and then Greenpeace and Nature Conservancy. And I realized that they were using my emotions, to get a hold of private property. And that's where I started researching, and this is where I am right now after 10 years, because I believe private property is what makes us free here in America. And to get back to your question, Roy, the World Bank does fund a lot of projects throughout the world. Now, what I will be talking about this evening is it is happening throughout the world. Central America, South America, Europe, Russia, China, you name it. This is happening throughout the world. Now, you will hear locally that the government is going to be decentralized, and so that means the Big Brother will not be looking over us, and the local government is going to control all the things that's happening locally. But beware, they are not, because the local government is going to get their orders and their instructions from the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the United Nations and all their agencies. And so I would like to mention that, because it is not local, it is international. Roy, it's so important to understand international. If you do not understand international, you will never understand what's happening locally. And water is so important, because if you have private property, you can use water for your crops, for your cattle. You can be productive and make money.
Well, if you can control the water, you can control everything.
Yes, including we humans. And so here in Santa Cruz County, it's so important to understand what's coming into the general plan. And also, they're going to have a water element into the general plan. And I go to the Santa Cruz County, which is in California. I go to the Water Advisory Commission meeting every month down at the county building.
Now, if it was in some other place across the country, would it be called the same type of agency? It would be a water commission or a water advisory board or
It would have water in the name of the agency, yes. And they would make recommendations to the Board of Supervisors or to the Board of Commissioners, they're called out in the Midwest. So this is the group that is getting instructions from the United Nations. And I'm going to go from the apex of the United Nations first. And a lot of people have heard about Agenda 21. Well, if you just go into Google and put Agenda 21, Chapter 18, Fresh Water, there's your blueprint. I just downloaded it, and it actually says the UN Department of Economic and Social Affairs, its Division for Sustainable Development. And underneath that is Agenda 21, Chapter 18, and how they're going to manage the fresh water resources. Now, this ties in very hand in glove with the World Bank water policy, because the World Bank is the one that funds the water projects. And so you need the money, and as soon as you sign that contract and say, well, I'm going to use the monies for restoring the riverbanks or for public outreach for educating the people on water issues, then you have given away the authority goes to the World Bank. And it does stipulate in the World Bank that any projects that they do give out, that the people that sign the contracts will have to follow the mandates of the World Bank.
Because whoever pays gets their way.
It's always been that way, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So here again, at the Water Advisory Commission meeting for the county, there is a lead agency that's pushing this international agenda. And this is in Santa Cruz County, California. It is the Environmental Health Agency.
And that's a county?
Yes.
Division?
Okay. Yes. It's an interesting agency because they look at the safety of the water. And there's always things that come up, there's red flags. And it said that the Regional Board of Water Quality still has the oversight of groundwater issues. And this is what I'm going into, groundwater this evening, and private water wells, because they're after the private water wells.
Why?
Because they want control of the private property, meaning they have to have control of the water so they can limit your water.
So if I'm a farmer and I have a well, they can say, well, you can only use so much water, so in that way they control what I can grow or what I can do with my property?
Yeah, but they got to have a reason, Roy. And this is very interesting because I've looked at this long and hard. And I thought, what are they going to come up with? Like the government and the environmentalists came up with a spotted owl that closed down the logging industry mm-hmm. in the Northwest. Well, these are the code names for red flags that are going to take your water away. It's called base flow or in-stream flow for the rivers. Now, this is important because what they're doing is using the fish, like the spotted owl.
Okay.
And so they say, well, we have to have a minimum amount of water in the rivers for the salmon, for the trout, you name it, whatever's threatened or endangered. And so it's arbitrary. Whoever sets these rules, they will be looking at how much water will be given back to the private property owners. So the first priority is they will set, it's called the in-stream flow rule, and they will have a certain amount of water in the rivers all the time. Now, when summer comes, they are actually going to close off some rivers for diversion, or they will use some rivers only in the winter time and close it only in the summer, the rivers. But this is how it connects with groundwater tables. If they're going to monitor the groundwater, the level, and if the level goes down in the groundwater table, then they say to the private well owners, okay, you're using too much. You're killing the fish. We have to get the water minimum standard up in the streams and the rivers. And so what they will do, they will allocate how much water the private water well owners will use. Now, how will they do that? They have to have meters on the private water wells. And this is one way of getting mandatory meters on all the private wells in the nation and throughout the world.
And I would guess if they have mandatory meters, that means they have mandatory access to your property.
Well, in the future, yes. But right now, they do not. And this is so critical for people that have private property with wells on their property. What the county is going to do, they're going to have a program. They're just going to start this in Santa Cruz, and I know it's been done throughout the United States before Santa Cruz. They're going to monitor the groundwater, the quality, the level, and that includes private water wells, mutual wells, and district county wells. And so for the private water wells, the county will come up and say, well, I'd like to see the quality of your water, and I'll work with you. And you say, well, that doesn't sound bad, and you let them on your property. That is the first mistake. Do not let the county or any public agency on your property, because you have given them voluntarily the right to come on your property, and that's the beginning of something that will actually invade your private property rights. And it's called in-stream flow, and also called base flow. This is so important, because this is how they're going to get the private well owners, and they will allocate a certain amount of water back to the well owner.
It sounds like, and I may be just shooting in the dark here, but isn't that similar to what they did to the folks in Klamath? Where they told they said, you know, there's not enough, you know, this fish in particular is having a problem, so we're going to take the water from you farmers and put it in the creek.
You mean the sucker fish?
There you go.
Well, I was up there, and I saw that beautiful lake. It was full. The water was so high, it came to the railroad tracks that was beside the lake. And it wasn't only the county or the state. The feds came in on that. And they stood guard over those gates. So you see what's happening is it's federal money coming in. Where does the federal money come from that was allocated? It's from the World Bank. And that's where it ties in. You see, they're protecting their resources. The World Bank is protecting their resources. Because the United States is so much in debt that there are papers, and the congressmen can't even see them, that it has been said that the states have given over their resources, the water, the land, and the people, to the World Bank in exchange for the debt. And so we have to be very careful that we retain our private property.
Now, someone, you know, is, again, just happening upon this radio station, and they're listening to us talk, and, you know, usually the first time around, it's kind of, you know, that really sounds unbelievable. Where can people find more about the World Bank?
Well, the World Bank is, you can find, actually, you can find it on your website, www, and that's freedom21santacruz.net.
It's always a good place to start.
/radio. And there's a tool for this first 30 minutes on water in the World Bank. And you click on that, and you're going to see these big document numbers. It is 12335.
Oh, I saw that, as a matter of fact. And there's that's not a recent document. That document's been around for a while.
1995. It hasn't been on the net until they put it on about 2002, and they let it go out on the net, which I was surprised. But if you don't know the document number, you will not be able to get it. You just can't find it. But it's on your website. It's wonderful. And it's called a World Bank Policy Paper, Water Resources Management. And management, they're going to manage everything.
That's those great webmasters of ours. You know, they get that information in. Pop,
yes,
it's right there.
I just love that. It's one of the few places you can find it. But everything is going to be charged for the water. There'll be pollution charges on your private land. Now, this also fits into the local water integrated plan of your county.
Does every county have one of those?
They're actually planning them now, and they're writing them down. Even the water districts have water management plans now. It's voluntary, but if you get money from the state, then you have signed a contract with the state, and then it's mandatory to have that water plan. So here again, it's voluntary if you want money from the state to enforce a restoration plan or public education plan. On the World Bank water policy, it ties in with the private water wells in the local integrated water plan, because the World Bank says that you will be charged a pollution tax for any pollution on your land. Now, that includes certain crops, if you put fertilizers, or if you have cattle, that manure and so forth. And so here again, it's the environmental health, especially in Santa Cruz County, that is going to take over the oversight of soil pollution near your wellhead, near your private well. And so it's the environmental health department that you really have to watch. Everything fits in so beautifully, Roy, regarding Agenda 21, the World Bank, and your local integrated water plan.
Well, I know. It fits so well. It's so scary. It doesn't really matter what part of your life you talk about. It fits right in there, and you can always go back to Agenda 21 or the UN policies or the World Bank, and we're going to talk more about that in a minute, but let's take a quick break.
The views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom. You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic. To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
Stations, that's what they're telling me. Environmental apocalypse, it sure is.
We're back on the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio program. I'm Roy Avila talking to Jeannie Soderman about your water and how it's trying to be controlled and to control you. Jeannie, you know, I think one thing that we need to keep hitting home is that every time someone is approached about getting funding or getting a grant or doing something, it always sounds really like it's going to be a good deal.
Well, that's true. And, of course, this is how they buy you off. It's a little bit like the mafia. And it does say in the World Bank water policy, it talks about water project loan agreements. And I've done a 7-page analysis of the World Bank water policy. I don't know if you have that, Freedom 21, but I know
I'm sure we'll get
Radio Liberty has that. And it's quite concise, but here I've mentioned, excuse me, about the water loan projects, and it does say, the World Bank water project loans clearly spell out that, quote, in acceptance of the monies of the World Bank, the countries must participate in the international initiatives. And those are the United Nations conventions, treaty agreements, and by signing this contract and accepting monies, these people must implement the World Bank policies on water and land use. See, land use goes hand in glove with this water policy, because if you use the land and you make pollution, shame on you. They're going to tax you. And I wanted to get back to this in-stream flow rule where they want enough water for the fish. That will cause, if that is signed into law, it will cause an artificial shortage of usable property, because you won't be able to use your property if you can't get enough water. And also, property taxes for parcels with wells, whether there's any structures on it or not, will go through the roof for pricing. And then properties that don't have wells, they'll go virtually down in value, and they'll be used just as open space. And, of course, people will move to the town, and you have smart growth, and the home prices will soar in pricing, and also, of course, the taxes will go up. So everything is connected, Roy. Now, what they're talking about is inflow rules and enough water for the fish in the streams. Being a former environmentalist, and I know I'm still one, very much a love of plants and animals, and but there's a balance in life. And if they want to control the flow of the rivers, well, build a reservoir, build a dam. But you know, in the biodiversity assessment report that came out, it was mandated by the Biodiversity Treaty. It does say that dams and reservoirs are unsustainable. So they've kind of got you between a rock and a hard place. They have a crisis, but they don't want to fix it. They want it there so they can take away your land, because you won't be able to pay your property taxes, because it will not be productive.
Well, and fear is the way to make people go along.
Yes, very definitely. They're doing this all over the United States. Small farmers are going out of business by the thousands. And they're also doing it throughout the world. And I can't stress that enough. You have to know international before you know local, because I'll talk to the local people in Santa Cruz County and talk about the World Bank, and they say, oh, that's way off in the distance. This has nothing to do with local issues. Not right. The World Bank is behind everything. They have the money, and they have the contracts to take your private property away.
Well, it looks like we're coming to the end of that half hour, and it always goes way too fast with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Roy.
Well, thank you, and thank you for all the work you're doing. And if you want to read some of the stuff that Jeannie's been talking about tonight, F21SC.net is where to get it, and we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio program. That song just cracks me up because it's so true, you know. And like they talk about sustainable development, it's just not sustainable. Our next guest is Logan Darrow Clements. He's the guy behind the Lost Liberty Hotel project. And again, the greatest thing about coming to do this radio program is learning about all the things that are going on. And Mr. Clements, are you with us?
I am.
Welcome to the Freedom 21 radio program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me a bit about the Lost Liberty Hotel project.
Well, on June 23rd, when the Supreme Court ruled in the Kelo versus City of New London decision that a city government can take private property and houses and land from one party and give it to another private party. If they think the second private party will generate more tax revenue and economic benefits, I thought, well, you know, perhaps the people that voted to it ought to have the rule applied to them. So I found the address of one of the justices, David Souter, who voted for it. And I looked at his land, 8 acres, and I said, you know what, that'd be a great place for a country inn, a hotel, so on and so forth. And so I decided to call it the Lost Liberty Hotel, because it will commemorate our lost liberty. And we're also going to have a restaurant in it called the Just Desserts Cafe, where we'll be serving up large slices of crow pie. And we're also going to have a museum of lost freedom, where we're going to chronicle all the freedoms we used to have when the country was founded and how law after law has slowly eaten away at them like a pack of piranhas to a person swimming across the lake. So that's what the development is all about, a lodging establishment, a restaurant, and a museum built on the land of Supreme Court Justice David Souter, who lives in Ware, New Hampshire.
You know, I've heard several times, you know, about the Kelo versus New London, and even though I've heard about it several times and I continue, it is unreal to believe that that happened. So for people who might just happen onto the show and you know, have just kind of heard it superficially, give us some details about how that all went down.
Well, there was a Pfizer, a pharmaceutical plant, or should I say office, a building in New London, Connecticut, and they wanted to expand. They wanted some of the land that was next to their building. A New London Development Corporation was created as a quasi-government agency. Those quasi-agencies you really have to watch out for. And they came up with this scheme of building all sorts of things. Actually, I think a hotel was among them, in a parking lot for the Pfizer employees and, several other things to invigorate the economy of New London, Connecticut. The problem was the land that they wanted to do this all on was occupied by a whole lot of people. Now, some of them sold, but others stood their ground and said, no, this is my house, and I'm not selling. There was one lady who had lived in the house all her life, I think 80-some-odd years, and a couple other people, including, of course, Suzette Kelo, who said, no, I'm not going to do it. And according to the Fifth Amendment Constitution, you're not allowed to take our land in our house, because the Fifth Amendment says that can only be taken for public use, and only if that occurs, then you have to pay just compensation. And public use has always meant something like a road or a courthouse, military base, something like that. But obviously, what they want to do is take it from these private owners and give it to another private owner, the New London Development Corporation.
Well, is that New London Development Corporation one of those public-private partnerships?
Yeah, basically the New London Development Corporation, is using the New London, City of New London, to, you know, use its power of force to force people to sell. You know, to say, look, we're going to end up taking your land anyway, so you might as well sell it to us.
And the city says, oh, sure, go ahead and do that on our behalf, because you know we'll make more tax money.
Yeah,
theoretically.
So what happened was that this case, Kelo versus City of New London, it worked its way all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, much to everyone's astonishment, said, yeah, it's okay, you can do that, because the logic they use, and I encourage anyone to download the Kelo versus City of New London decision, they can find it on the internet. Basically, it lowered the bar, and it said, if it is a well-thought-out plan, and it promotes economic development, that's a public benefit, and you know, it's the public use because it's a commercial establishment that, you know, the public will use. So they lowered the bar right down to the ground, basically. So now no business is safe, because you know, there's always some other type of business that could generate more tax revenue than your business, and no house is definitely safe, because a business will almost always generate more tax revenue than what you're paying in property taxes. So on June 23rd, we all lost our property rights, basically. Quite scary.
And where is that project now? I mean, are they breaking ground? Is it changed? What's actually happening there?
Well, it's very complicated. There's sort of been a breakdown amongst the aggressors in that battle, in that after the Kelo decision came down and there was a huge public outcry against it. In New Hampshire, they did a survey, the University of New Hampshire, and they found that 93% of residents, at least of New Hampshire, were opposed to the Kelo decision. So the state of Connecticut said, slow down here. Let's wait until we have some more time to think about this. And so they tried to tell the New Hampshire, or the New London, rather, Development Corporation to, just hold off on evicting people and so on and so forth. And as I understand it, the city of New London as well told them to, slow down, let's take some more time, let's think about this, because it's a very contentious issue. And the New London Development Corporation said, okay, we won't evict them. And then they went ahead and sent out eviction notices. And not only that, but they charged people back rent for living in their own houses from the day a couple years ago when they first started the action to take their property. It's just government gone wild, government out of control.
And so what's happened to those poor people who supposedly owed all that back rent?
Well, they're not paying it, of course, and they are just holding their ground. There were eviction notices sent out that would have had, this Kelo out by sometime in December, but they were rescinded by the City of New London, so it's kind of up in the air right now. But I know one thing for sure, if they ever do evict them, there are a lot of people, including myself, who plan on going to New London, Connecticut, and surrounding the house in an Elian Gonzalez-style protection action. Because we have to take a stand. This is just gone too far. I mean, government is just getting bigger and bigger. It takes more and more of our money and more of our freedom every day. It's just a continual march towards statism. And we have to take a stand, because the problem is that government doesn't usually take giant leaps forward that get people so angry. Now, in this case, they did, actually. But usually it takes away our liberty bit by bit, and never so much that people get riled up. And that's one reason we're losing our freedom, is because they're taking it in little pieces, bit by bit. And the other thing is that, a lot of people lack the philosophic underpinning to properly defend freedom. That we are humans, we use our mind to obtain the values that we need to live and be happy. And we can't use our mind if we're not free to act on the decisions we make. And we can't live if the government takes the property that we earn. So you hear people trying to defend freedom and property rights using all sorts of secondary and tertiary arguments when they could use much more powerful ones. And that's the second reason we're losing our freedom. And then the third reason we're losing our freedom, in my opinion, is that people are too fearful.
Let's afraid say to say no. Yeah.
Afraid to stand up. Now, here's an example. I really want to get on videotape a person being dragged out of their house on eviction day by the police, because I believe that will drive home to the American public what is really going on, and it will really clarify that we have to put an end to this.
You're right.
Now, I have a guy in Washington, D.C., who's under eminent domain. I won't name him. He is in the shadow of a development for a new stadium, of course, taxpayer-funded, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Owning a sports team is a nice business, because you get the taxpayers to pay for your factory, So they are trying to take his house, and this guy is a former military guy. I believe he was in Desert Storm. And I said to him, I'm trying to make a movie about eminent domain abuse. I need video of somebody being dragged out of their house on the last day. What do you think? And he's like, oh, geez, I don't know. And I'm like, come on, you were over in the Middle East. They were trying to kill you. They were shooting at you. You did that. You took that risk, you know, to liberate the people of Kuwait. Well, come on now. Liberate the people of America. You might spend one night in jail, maybe a week, you know. And he was like, oh, gee, I don't know about that, you know. So it just frustrates me because you cannot have a risk-free revolution. We cannot have a revolution on our sofas. We cannot have a revolution sitting behind our computers at home typing out email. We are going to have to take matters into our own hands to defend our freedom. And we're going to have to stand up and say, what I'm doing isn't wrong. This is my house. And if you want to drag me out by force, you're going to have to do it in front of the cameras, of which all America will see it. And we just don't have enough of those people.
I think you're right. You know, you were talking about how the government takes bit by bit by bit, and it seems like these days they're getting pretty bold. I think they're trying to test people, see what we put up with.
And very few things really get people worked up enough. You know, I mean, this is one of the few instances where people really did get pretty upset about it. But generally speaking, there's not much you can do. You know, you've only got one vote. And, you know, between the two parties, there frequently isn't a whole lot of difference sometimes, it appears. You know, one party votes for bigger government, more taxes, they get kicked out of office, and then the new party votes for bigger government, more taxes.
Yep. Talk about your Lost Liberty Hotel. Where are you on your project?
Where we are now is that we have a group of supporters in Ware, New Hampshire, that's formed, it's called the Citizens for the Protection of Natural Rights. And if people want to, you know, donate to that group, then go to my website, freestarmedia.com. That's free as in freedom. And what they're doing is they're going to put an initiative on the ballot in Ware, New Hampshire, that asks the town to take Souter's land for the purpose of economic development, which is allowed under the ruling which he voted for, to build an inn.
I guess he's heard about it. Have you had any response from... the judge?
Not directly, but ABC Nightline did a story on my project, and they talked to Souter's minister, I believe, or priest or whatever, mm-hmm. And he said, oh, Souter thought it was, you know, he had a laugh. He said, oh, good, maybe I'll get a good price for my home now, you know, which to me shows that he's very out of touch with what eminent domain is all about. And it underscores the need for what we're doing, because what we're trying to do with this project, in a big sense, is we're trying to have an educational project for 5 special needs students who don't know enough about the Fifth Amendment and the need for property rights. And so we're doing a little homeschooling here, because normally when somebody is under the threat of eminent domain, they do not get the market value of their house. So when Souter said that, oh, you know, great, I'll get a good price for my house, it really said, you know, keep going, Logan. he really needs to learn a little bit about eminent domain and what he voted for.
Talk a little bit about eminent domain and what really happens to people that fall under it.
Well, what normally happens, and I'm not the best expert in this area. The Institute for Justice has a subgroup called the Castle Coalition, and they are the real experts on this. But I've, you know, read up on some of the publications, and normally what happens is that the city says, oh, gee, our downtown or whatever area it is, you know, it's not really doing that great. So they come up with some grand scheme, some central planning, and they draw this map, and they draw a boundary line around it. And most people don't even realize that they're inside this boundary. And they may find out, you know, through the grapevine, like, hey, did you know that we're in this redevelopment zone? No. You know, and so eventually they find out. The city sometimes just puts small notices in the classified sections of papers that, you know, is all that they're required to do under the law.
Because they probably already have their predetermined plan of what they want to go on there anyway.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, they have some big grand scheme, you know, some Ceausescu like, you know, grand scheme for how they're going to make it a beautiful city, and they're going to decide.
A sustainable neighborhood, and in our next hour, we'll be talking a lot about that.
Yeah, and so what happens next is that the development company, which is, like you said, a public-private partnership, goes to these people and says, hey, you're in a development area. You know what? You better sell to us, because if you don't, you know, we can just use eminent domain and take your house at whatever we feel like paying. So a lot of people usually, you know, just go ahead and sell and just get out. But then they have public meetings about it, and they always say the same thing publicly. This is, you know, the government officials talking. They say, well, no, we're not planning to use eminent domain. That would only be as a last resort. Which, if you think about it logically, is a contradiction, because a last resort means that there are some people who don't want to sell. You know, so obviously it's not really a last resort. For the people that don't want to sell, it's the first resort. Mm-hmm. You know, they offer them price. They say, no, I don't want to sell. Okay, we're going to use eminent domain on you. So it's the same thing over and over, and in one community after the other. They come up with a scheme. They get people to sell, you know, threatening them with what they could do. But publicly they say, oh, we're not going to use eminent domain. It's a last resort. And then eventually they do use it. And then they build some big development, usually taxpayer subsidized, and frequently it fails.
Okay, we're going to be right back, talk a little bit more to you, but let's take a break.
Thank you.
Welcome back. We're talking to Logan Darrell Clements on the Lost Liberty Hotel. Now, what's the city's position on your proposal?
The politicians that are currently in control of the Ware New Hampshire government are opposed to it. There's a knee-jerk reaction, but there's an election on March 14th, 2006, and there are 5 seats on the board. 2 of them are up for election, and some of the people in town that support my project are planning to run for those seats. And they're hoping that if they get in, if they get 2 people in there, maybe they can flip, you know, one more and then have a majority. Otherwise, they'd have to wait another year to get the control of the city. So we have 2 things going on in Ware, New Hampshire. The initiative, and then also people running for office there as well. And we have a national organization, Freedom Works, which has 700,000 plus members, which is going to help out the local group there and where to get the initiative passed and hopefully get some of our supporters into office.
I remember when you first came out with this, some folks just thought it was kind of a joke.
Yeah, most people did, and that's why I put in the press release that it wasn't a prank. I mean, it's very doable, and I'll tell you why. I mean, there are only 5 people on the Board of Selectmen, so if we somehow get 3 supporters elected, then that will do it. To put an initiative on the ballot only requires 25 signatures. That's 2-5. And there are only 5,500 registered voters in Ware, New Hampshire, of which only 2,038 showed up at the last election.
Wow.
So anyone who thinks it's a joke just hasn't heard those numbers yet. You know, so I get that reaction from everyone. Oh, yeah, you know, that's really great, Logan, but yeah, it's just a joke. It's just a prank, right? And then I tell them the numbers, and they're like, oh, wow. You could actually do this. So, yeah, it's real. And I've got several developers that are interested in doing the project.
Well, I bet,
trying to narrow it down to whoever I think is the best to endorse as far as somebody who has a lot of experience and also has the enthusiasm for the project and the ideological underpinnings to defend it properly.
So
that's where I am on the business track. Is
right.
Trying to
so the next big thing is in March for the election.
Right.
And then what? What do you think is going to happen after that?
Well, I really hope that our initiative will get passed and that we'll have 2 people in office out of the 5 there and where, and that, you know, we can go ahead with acquiring his land, giving him just compensation. What we're really trying to do is simulate the experience for Justice Souter that people that have been under eminent domain experience. So, you know, we'll offer him a price that we think is fair for his land, like other people have gotten a fair price for their land.
And what is it usually, pennies on the dollar?
I don't know if it's that bad. Usually, you know, people sometimes get half of what it's worth, or I've even heard less than that.
And the way it's going these days, they wouldn't even be able to buy their own home.
Yeah. And they based the price on when the eminent domain action was started. And some of these court battles go on for years, and the price of the house goes up over those years, yet it's based on the price, you know, right in the beginning. So it's just injustice all the way around. I mean, the 2 main injustices are, 1, people are forced to sell, they don't want to sell, and 2, they're not given the market value of their house after they have their house stolen from them. You know, and it just underscores the point that I frequently make, that government has become photo negative, which means it's doing all the things it shouldn't do and neglecting the few things that it should do. I mean, government should stop theft. And in this case, it's carrying out theft.
It should protect the people.
Yeah, to protect our property rights. I mean, and it's much worse than a thief. A thief might steal your stereo or your wallet. Governments are stealing your entire house.
Okay, well, we want to thank you for being with us and for all the work you're doing. And if you want to keep up on it, it's www.freestarmedia.com. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Welcome back to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio program. And if you listen to this program on a regular basis, or even if you just happen to fall upon it, you might say to yourself, you know, it's hard to believe all this stuff is going on. And in the short time that we have with you every week, it's really hard to tell you all of the things that are going on. But if you go to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz website, there's a bunch of material there for you to learn more. There's the Understanding Sustainable Development, a guide for public officials. If you just heard about this and you want to know more, it's a great tool. You know, it's a quick study on what's going on in every facet of your life. We have a couple of series of The War on Reason. Michael Shaw does a great job of talking about how our liberty is just being assaulted on a regular basis. And we have a new one, Transforming America, Sustainable Development, The Loss of Your Rights and the Creation of Crisis, Shortage, and a Police State. And those are all really good things. And there's a bunch more on there. So check out f21sc.net and learn and get involved. Our next guest, this one is a spooky kind of a thing. We're going to compare 1960s land use planning in the USSR to current day development here in the United States and worldwide. We'll find out if this is the kind of community that you want to live in. And we are going to talk to now Freedom 21 Santa Cruz director and editor Joanne Nathan. Welcome, Joanne.
Hello, Roy.
You know, I was talking with Michael Shaw a couple of weeks ago. He was telling me about this, and I have actually talked to other people about this. I was talking to someone about the whole not having a kitchen. When Michael was saying, oh, yeah, you know, back in the 1960s in Russia, they were planning, you know, you don't need to have a kitchen because we're going to have places in the community that you can go out and eat, and you don't have to cook, or we don't want you to cook. And then he told me we were going to talk to you about this, and I said, oh, this is going to be good.
Well, it's true. Kitchens, having a kitchen for a single family is considered wasteful or, you know, overabundant. And tonight what I'm going to do is read from a 1961 journal from the Soviet Review, which contains articles that were most representative of the time. So we're going to look at land use planning in the 1960s in the USSR. And it's interesting, we'll get to kitchens. But this first article is called What Will Our Future Cities Look Like? By A. Obrazov. So he goes on to say, some interesting figures were presented at the International Congress of Architects in Moscow. It was figured that by the end of the century, there would need to be 15 million apartments, just 15 million apartment units to be built in the Soviet Union. And of course, a corresponding number of schools, kindergartens, motion pictures, theaters, shops, clubs, and other public and cultural service buildings.
Okay, hang on right there. We're going to take a quick break and come back to your comments on Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, right after this. We're back on the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio program with Joanne Nathan. We're comparing 1960s land use planning in the USSR with what's happening today right here in your own town.
Right. So in the architects are talking about a massive amount of apartment units being built, and they're also presenting it in ways that will appeal to the populace, schools, motion picture theaters, shops, making it very attractive, much like we see some of the smart growth happening in our area today with pretty planter boxes and things look really good and they sound really good. But what are the architects, engineers, and builders' conceptions of these new cities in the USSR for the end of the century? Well, they say they will not build streets bordered on both sides by houses, nor will there be any residential houses with inner yards and passages. So they're talking about suburbia and single-family homes here. It is planned to build houses of several types. There will be hotel-type houses designed for bachelors and families of two. Such houses will be integrated with a public service block. Here, residents will be able to have their clothes mended and washed. There will be a small club for rest, dancing, etc. Apartment houses of 4 to 5 stories for medium-sized families will be the most frequent type that will be built. And last but not least, there will be houses for large families. These will be 2-story cottages. Okay, now this is sounding, well, it can be very attractive to some people to live in what's now being called in the U.S. and in Santa Cruz, single-room occupancy units. That might be great for some people who want a low-maintenance kind of dwelling for a period of time. And I know I've been excited about living in an urban environment with a small apartment and being able to walk to everything. But what's missing here is the alternative, the choice, because there is a real disdain for suburbia or rural living. And that's what we're going to see as we hear more from these architects. Obviously, it's central planning going on, too, because the USSR Academy of Building Construction and Architecture has worked out a system where each district is divided into residential compounds called micro-districts with a population of 6,000 to 10,000. And each micro-district will have 1 school, 2 combined preschool children's establishments, a kindergarten and a nursery, a food shop, personal service shops, cafeteria, club, building maintenance office. Then the residential houses within a micro-district are grouped into smaller compounds with a population of about 2,000.
Okay, hang on right there. We're going to take another quick break.
Okay.
We're back on the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio program with our guest Joanne Nathan talking about, and it's just weird, you know, that you're reading from 1960s USSR planning documents, and when you're talking, I'm envisioning most neighborhoods that we're seeing going up right now.
Well, certainly where we live, Roy, we're seeing that, and some people are still somewhat protected by this because they're living out in the country, but yeah, if people open their eyes, they're going to see these more compact housing types.
Or just drive into your nearest city and you'll see it.
Right. They're more like projects being built, and as I'm talking about these micro-districts, I can think of the Association of Bay Area Governments in Silicon Valley, where they have a plan for residential areas, mixed-use areas, town centers, and a whole new structure for neighborhoods and where people are going to be living. So the parallels are happening, and they're being implemented to a T. But all the time, it's packaged with a really pretty wrapper. We can think of Santana Row. You have Tiffany's and Ben and Jerry's ice cream and fancy clothes stores and these things that are very quaint, and it feels like you're in a European village, but you look up above and they're very crammed in apartments, and who knows what kind of rules and regulations those people are under, or if they bought their condo, do they really own it?
No, I don't think you can buy there.
Okay, well, there are other places where
you can just lease.
You can lease, okay. But I'm sure there are rules and regulations.
Oh, I am sure there's a homeowners association. I know folks who go down there to try to put on events,
mm-hmm.
and there's so many rules of how to behave and how big it's regulated to the teeth.
Right, and cars, it's very difficult to drive around in a car there. And it's very unsafe to be a pedestrian because there are no curbs. And it's just a very strange planning to me. It doesn't seem like they were taking our health and safety into consideration. But it looks pretty cute. You know, it looks like Disneyland.
Right.
So we can see that the Moscow architects were doing the same thing. They're planning on getting people into compact, highly controlled areas, but putting the flower pots outside and the movie theaters, and notice the emphasis on schools and kindergartens and even creches, which are public nurseries where the mothers who work leave their children. So there's a plan not only to control how and where people live, but how the children are raised. And we see that with a lot of new developments going up where child care centers are built into the project.
Oh, yeah, a lot of the new stuff that I'm seeing is what they call live to work.
Uh-huh. Or like a walkable community, something like that.
Or like you can do your business downstairs and live upstairs.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is what they said in Russia. A new type of living quarters will be developed along the lines of uniting establishments for public use with residential units. Okay, this is the trend in the USSR in 1960. Well, can I jump over to...
Please. For me, it's like taking class here.
All right, well, I'd like to just jump quickly to current-day St. Petersburg because I have an Associated Press article from 2003, May 2003. This is the time frame that these planners were envisioning. And I'd like to read a little bit about this one family. They're called the Kukushkina family, and they live in an apartment. It happens to be a big apartment with 7 bedrooms, but 5 families share this apartment. So there's 7 bedrooms, 5 families, 1 kitchen, and 1 bathroom.
Wow.
And this is in St. Petersburg that we know is being touted as a very touristy come and visit place, but tourists are seeing a lot of the good stuff.
Well, they're just seeing the Disneyland part of it.
Exactly. So the mother in this apartment says, "I've actually already gotten used to this life and given up dreams of having our own apartment." She lives with her husband, her 5-year-old son, and 10-month-old son. 11 other people share the rest of the house. The Kushkush can put 2 double beds in their room, one for the parents and one for the children, along with a refrigerator and a dining table. This is in one room. 10-month-old Zena, whose hair is bright green from the antiseptic used to relieve the itching from a recent bout with chickenpox, prances in his walker in tight circles across the small space carved out for a play area. Kukushkina, a housewife, says she has learned to live with the poverty and inconvenience, but not with one of the neighbors. He has allegedly defecated in the bathtub. Mm. Remember, there's only one bathroom. Uh-huh. Threatened to pour boiling water on her children and tried to attack her husband with a knife. A court is now weighing whether the other residents have the right to evict the man. So here you are in a very highly controlled housing unit where you can't choose who you're living in the same apartment with.
Because it's government housing.
Exactly. And that's what we're moving toward, is government control of our planning and housing. And it's coming from the federal government on down. So, going on, back to this 1960s, there's another article, and the authors are Zhu Rozliev and Fyodorov. And they're talking about old living versus new, the micro-district and new living conditions. And they say that too many people in the West think that the ideal of a comfortable dwelling is a private house with many rooms.
Oh, there we go. Now we're getting down to it here.
Right. There's a disdain for people being comfortable. So, but after the question arises whether there is any need for such abundance in rooms in an apartment, we don't see that there are rooms required other than for sleeping. And maybe some home occupation during one's free time. Boarding schools, kindergartens, and creches will make our life easier in many ways. Thus, there will be no need for individual kitchens and storage rooms. Now there comes the kitchens and the storage rooms. I'm thinking that could be a garage. Obviously, there's no accommodating an automobile here in the Soviet Union in the 1960s. Public education is of special importance in the formation of the man of the future communist society. I'm quoting here. Under collective methods of upbringing in boarding schools and kindergartens where the children stay all week long, our children, experiencing the beneficial influence of their co-equals, will be brought up from an early age in a spirit of collectivism. Extreme individualism and egotism, so frequently characteristic of spoiled children reared in small families, will be eradicated. A new type of living quarters will be developed along the lines of uniting establishments for public use with residential units. This trend in many architectural projects represented the USSR exhibition of urban construction in the spring of 1960. So if we jump forward to today, I can look at the American Planning Association, and they, for a long time, have been receiving funding from the federal government. And they, too, want to develop compact urban areas where people do not live in the rural areas, do not control the resources and have farms, unless they're special farmers who go along with the program.
I bet the architectural group gets a lot of grant money, too.
Absolutely. Well, the American Planning Association and the AIA, yes, they do. It's interesting on an international level what's happening, because Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General, says the most creative agents of change may well be partnerships among governments, private businesses, nonprofit organizations, scholars, and concerned citizens such as you. The issue is not environment versus development or ecology versus economy. We need to integrate the two. So here we have the United Nations espousing this. We have countries all over the world. We talk to people in Great Britain, Italy, Israel, France. The same thing is happening there, and the agenda is the same. It happens to be Agenda 21. So we can call this program of herding us into dense urban settlements smart growth, which I like to define smart growth as rails, trails, and high-density government-controlled housing. Or we can call it new urbanism. There are lots of different names for it. But the bottom line is control of where we live, what we eat, how we're schooled, how our public health is handled. And that's the concern, is more than how where we live, but it's going to change our way of government, our economy, and our justice, our form of that we've come so used to having.
And it's happening right now.
It's happening right now. It is. And it's not happening to everybody at the same time. It's little bits and pieces here and there, so that in one neighborhood something might be happening that is different than the other neighborhood. So it doesn't appear as this blanketing change that's coming over us. But it's happening fast and furiously, and a lot of people are getting funding, and their livelihoods depend on this. They don't know the evil behind the plan. They don't know that it's taking away our sense of being Americans, with a sense of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness or property, to a global collective where we are under the control of big government.
Well, you know, I don't get an opportunity to travel much out of state, but I do travel a lot in the San Francisco Bay Area. And you know, I hear you talking, and I can just think of a lot of developments. You know, they're all mostly condos and apartments.
Mm-hmm.
They're usually on the bus stop or by the transit or whatever. And now, I know in San Jose, in some of the business parks,
they're taking down some of the business parks and putting apartments and condos so they can be close to where the jobs are. So they can eliminate the cars. And in many of these developments, there's no garage.
No garage. And you think, well, you know, that might be okay for a young single person who can just drive himself around, but it doesn't work for a family. What happens when you want to have company over or guests that do drive cars? There's no place to park for these people. So it becomes sort of an isolated existence where you're forced to socialize with your apartment complex or housing complex.
Well, in a lot of these complexes, from what I understand, there's a mandatory, quote, low-income quota. And a lot of these people who buy into these communities don't even really get to own it.
That's right.
They live in it for a while. They think they have some equity, and they're going to sell their first house and live the American dream and go buy another one. Then they find out that that equity is not theirs.
Exactly. They have a capped sales price, and it goes back to the redevelopment agency that initially helped get those developments off the ground. So a lot of people are being fooled. I know there was a woman who needed a permit to have her children, her grandchildren, spend the night. People don't do well if they don't have a choice about where they're living. Urban environments are great for some people, but not for everybody. And the plan here is to put most people in these types of communities. Another article on our website on the advanced bulletin of freedom21santacruz.net, Camille Gilio of Walnut Creek writes about how their smart growth in Contra Costa County, California is just flourishing. And she says residents of Walnut Creek and Contra Costa will age graciously or age in place. I put those words in quotes because that's what the line that's being given to them. With the help of nonprofits, faith-based groups, foundations, government healthcare planners, and this is the same thing that was being done in 1960 USSR, but today it's called Contra Costa for every generation. And it really makes it difficult for these people to live a life outside of the home that they, the small home that they make for themselves. Because they won't have cars, and their meals will be prepared, and the social events will be planned. But it's a good article, and it's today, and it's in the Bay Area, and I look at it on the Advanced Bulletin. So there's something that's been very chic about attracting people in, and needs to be examined, what will this mean for the people living there down the road.
That seems to be a common theme, no matter what topic we talk about in this radio program. That it's always very well packaged.
Yeah, I mean, we're surrounded by warm and fuzzy words. Who doesn't want to live in a community where you can walk? But a walkable community is a smart growth community, so look into it. The planning through the American Association, they are actually giving statutes to the federal government, which are being handed down through legislative lobbying, that incorporate bringing in these nonprofit groups and private commissions and study groups. So we're also losing our we the people powers in our elected officials, because our elected officials are allowing their responsibilities to leak out to these non-elected, oftentimes self-appointed bureaucrats and planners who are not only planning land use, but there's social engineering going on.
Well, a lot of times, like when we talk about homeowners associations, the elected officials give up their responsibilities to the homeowners associations to provide their own police or their own security and their own garbage pickup, and it ends up being pretty much non-elected officials running the communities.
Right, and they these neighborhood groups and homeowners associations end up getting some people that fancy themselves very important, and they partner with some of the politicians who are on the same agenda, because it's typically the lobby groups that got those politicians in the first place. So they're very partial to making these new urbanism smart growth plans happen. But when a private entity partners with government, it is no longer private. It's more like the fascist regime. And even a private business that partners with government is not going to put the customer as king. Government becomes their boss and their lifeblood. And so that's why I'm seeing a lot of small businesses really struggling, because they're independent thinkers. They want to please the customer. And a lot of the larger corporations have the funding to be extorted and give up green space if they build a big box store. They're always making deals. And free enterprise and the little guy is being pushed out here to where we'll become, if this isn't stopped, restoration, swamp managers. We can learn how to pull weeds or soil the soil, or get into a factory job. Our choices will become more limited, and we're already feeling that. A lot of people are losing their jobs and losing their livelihoods, being forced into circumstances of dependency. This does not make for a healthy, thriving society.
Well, and again, just going to this program and the work of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, these ideas and all these plans have been forwarded over a very long period of time.
That's right. A long time. And it's interesting that in the Soviet Union, Khrushchev was with Eisenhower, and they were flying over the United States. And he said, why do you keep your people so spread out? He saw the suburban, what today is called sprawl. And he said, you need to get them close together because they're easier to control. So in the 60s, there was that aspect of being able to control people, but they also talked of it being a cheaper way of building, because government was in charge of the housing. There was no private enterprise, so they did the cheapest possible construction. And today, that wouldn't work here. So the environment, I find it interesting that the environment is used as the reason to herd us into these smart growth communities. There's always something, but it wasn't the environment back in the 60s. That came in the 70s.
We have a caller on the line.
Okay.
Jamie, you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you for coming back.
This is interesting, because I downloaded off of your website, freedom21santacruz.net, and I downloaded the information that Joanne is giving this evening, and it surprises me that they want to replace the home kitchen and do away with petty household chores. And, that's what keeps a family together, is you gather around the kitchen table and you feel good and your belly's full and you feel happy, and the members of the family talk and talk out problems and so forth. And that's what they want to do, is get rid of the family unit. That was one of the main objectives of the Communist Manifesto, is do away with family, and the socialists of the United States, Rockefeller and so forth. Do you have any thoughts on that, Joanne?
Well, that's absolutely right. I look at these programs and I think, is this really healthy? Is this healthy for individuals? Is it healthy for families? Is this a healthy way to have society function? No, it leads to depression, sorrow, hopelessness. When people can't express themselves or share time with their family because their children are stuck in nursery schools and kindergartens and daycare because they have to work two jobs, I don't think that makes for a healthy society. It happens, and people can raise good children that way, but it's hard. And
well, when you were both talking, I started to think, and it comes from learning from you all, no, it's not healthy. I like to eat out as much as anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But I know when I eat at home, I know exactly what's going into what I'm feeding my family.
That's right.
And then if you go out and eat all the time, gee, now, it could be, you know, that's part of it. We eat out so much, now we have an obesity thing. So then we got to go to the doctor, we got to have a new program, we got to take these certain kinds of drugs. You know, and then you read about all the health documents that come off the Freedom 21 agenda, or excuse me, the Agenda 21, all health, and, you know, it all ties into me.
Well, you wonder what they're actually putting in your food, too, because they'll have control of the food gardens. And that's interesting, because I don't know, Joanne, that you know about this Natural Bridges Eco Village in Santa Cruz, on the west side of Santa Cruz, California. And I was just reading about it, and they call it Eco Village Community. They'll use cluster housing, and I think that's what you were talking about. And they'll have a community farmer or a gardener, and that gardener will be hired by the Homeowners Association. So here again comes the rules and regulations of the Soviet Council, which is the Homeowners Association. And that will provide the food for the community. Very, very interesting. And Joanne, you talked about, which brought to mind, there wouldn't be many rooms in the units for the people to live. And that's so important because, as I'm thinking, the controlled environment, the socialists, the apex of the Soviet Council, the Homeowners Association, in order to control you, they don't want you to mingle with other people so you can express what's happening or your discontent. In other words, like you said, they want to isolate you.
And from other neighborhood groups.
Other people. And that's where there's going to be less rooms, and you're going to go to the community hall and eat, and you'll have surveillance cameras, and there's really no place to talk. Now, I was thinking about there's going to be like a service block where they're going to wash your clothes, mend your clothes, then they're going to feed you. And I was thinking about the water situation again. Well, we don't need much water in our individual units where we're going to live, because they're going to wash our clothes. They're going to make the meals. We don't have to wash the dishes. So they'll give us, like they say in the Agenda 21, the International Agenda 21, all we need for basic needs is 10.5 gallons of water a day.
No cooking, no cleaning. You're right.
Amazing. But I'm really appreciating this show because it ties everything in together, what I've learned, and how they plan to control the resources and also the human resources. So thanks for your research on that.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for calling.
Bye.
Bye.
You know, and while Jeannie was talking here about, you know, you're going to stand in line for your food, and you're going to, if I had to live in that kind of condition, I'd have to go, I'd probably blow up, and then I'd have to be assigned to the mental health part of it.
Well, that would keep the pharmaceutical companies in business, right?
Yeah.
That's the design.
You know, then because my children would have to have mental health screening at the school.
Absolutely.
Because their dad went off because he was living in this, you know, room with 20 other people and one bathroom.
That's right. In fact, can I just give the definition of new urbanism?
Oh, please.
Okay, Michael Park, who also has an article about Katrina, and is new urbanism.
Well, that's really something to watch. We really got to watch what happens
right,
there.
Right, the new urbanists are looking at the hurricane victims in that area as a good way to put in smart growth Agenda 21 living conditions. But I think he describes it really well in his article on the Advanced Bulletin. He says, new urbanism is a school of planning and architectural design that forms the foundation of smart growth, which is concerned with legal and political enforcement of the new urban standards. With strong centralized design based around neighborhood centers, new urbanism seeks to design self-sufficient communities where any citizen can live, work, and play all within a small radius, just what you're talking about. Why would you pack people in? We have these self-imposed urban service boundaries. There is so much open space in the United States. We need to spread out.
Oh, for sure. But, you know, when after listening to Michael Shaw, they want us all in these little, so that the people who rule will have all everything else to themselves.
That's right. An elitist playground out there in the Wildlands Project, or the open space corridors that are going to surround these eco-villages, will just be a buffer zone to the playground for the wealthy.
Yeah, they'll be able to look at us like we're in the zoo. Oh, look at those are people over there in the little smart growth village. Aren't they cute?
Well, there's actually a Gaia conference, which is the spiritual view that Mother Nature is God. And in this conference, there was a man that actually talked about how the goal would be to have humans in the cages with the animals looking in.
Oh, because we're bad at evil?
Yes. So there's a whole ideology here that is very upside down from, once again, what I think makes for a healthy society and healthy people.
Well, you know, again, the thing that it's spooky how they talked about this 40 years ago. And it's happening. And we always just, you know, we're not going to let that happen here. That won't happen here. And I remember listening to one of these shows where, I don't know if it was one of the Soviet leaders says, you know, we'll win without ever firing a shot.
Right. Right. And it's happening. Back in 1993, some meat was put into these policies and programs with President Clinton's executive order that established the Council on Sustainable Development. And that called for basically changing the infrastructure of the nation away from private property ownership and control of property to national zoning and government control. So that's when, during the 90s, a lot of this planning stuff really ramped up, and we saw the nonprofits grow with funding. And they survived for the most part because they advanced this agenda. That's very dangerous.
Now, for people who might not live, you know, in one of these kinds of areas, we all know it's going to come to a neighborhood near you very soon. What are the kinds of things that you know they should be on the lookout for, so you know they're ahead of the game?
Well, consensus meetings, facilitated meetings where it appears that the community is involved in the planning process.
And you really have to pay attention, because this isn't the kind of thing that they put on the front page of the local newspaper.
Right. Sometimes it's buried. Come out and join us for lunch or cookies, and we'll plan. And they actually have blocks and maps on tables, but each table is very well controlled with someone who is working towards this predetermined agenda. In fact, it's interesting, Bill Clinton and Bruce Babbitt did something like that. They conducted a consensus meeting on planning, for national planning, and used charrettes. Have you ever heard of these charrettes?
No.
Well, apparently the charrette is an agent for change that invites people in the community to come and plan. And what these people who go need to realize is that they're talking about other people's properties.
Right.
Sometimes
it's nice to say, oh, gee, do that on their property.
Yeah, I mean, what gives them the right to say, oh, that cottage over there is underutilized, and we think that should be a mixed-use complex with retail on the bottom and living on the top. That's someone's home.
You know, I went to one of those kind of meetings. It was in, I think out here in the Aptos Village plan.
Exactly.
Where they looked at a map and said, oh, you know, that's an antique store over there, and we should change that to a park or, you know, something like that.
Right, which is outrageous. So, I mean, to get people who are willing to assume that kind of responsibility is a problem, and they're, unfortunately, there are too many people who think they can play SimCity for real.
Stay on the computer. We have another caller. We have Daniel from Santa Cruz.
Hi, Daniel.
Yes, good evening.
Good evening.
Yeah, I've been recently, I've been hearing this, I believe it's a government-sponsored radio ad, and it emphasizes the need for a preschool, and the reason for this is that this early childhood training will, as they say, lead to the creation of a well-trained workforce.
Exactly.
And, I mean, I thought, you know, we had individualism in this country. It just sounds like they're trying to create these drones.
Right, and that's what our federal educational programs like School to Work or No Child Left Behind, Goals 2000, those are all designed, despite their warm and fuzzy names, to create that global citizen and worker.
It's all very scary.
Well, in the state of California, it's first five. That now they want to get you at from one to three, and there's millions, if not billions of dollars in the state of California to get everybody into the early, and remember everyone, this is the opinion of the host, into the early childhood indoctrination programs.
That's certainly what it seems like to me.
Right.
Well, because what do they teach? They even change the books. The classic stories they change to,
modified.
Yeah.
I believe it. I know it's happening. That was my only comment.
Well, thanks, Daniel, because schools are becoming the centers of community.
I have no doubt. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you. In fact, there are two things on using young people as agents of change, and that change is this Agenda 21. It means the same thing. But here's on the UN level. The UN has declared 2005 to 2014 the decade on education for sustainable development. So Global Vision is developing a global curriculum for the UN, which will be completed in 2007. The curriculum targets youth and focuses on world problems and solutions in areas of environment, health, economics, education, and social. This curriculum will go out to many countries. And then I can... That's on the big scope, and I can look at someone who's working as a planner on sustainable behavior, because this is really about changing our behavior.
Oh, sure. Look at all the big push now is for mental health screening of the children.
Exactly. So this woman says she's a project manager for a small project on environmentalism that used local high school and university kids to go door to door to encourage people to conserve energy. We believe that young people are the agents of change.
Oh, sure. If you look at any of the environmental, they always use the kids.
Yeah.
We have another caller on the line. We have Claudine in Lake County. Welcome, Claudine.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. I have a granddaughter and a daughter in Santa Cruz. Anyway, question I have to ask, we are in redevelopment. This is a little town called Lucerne. And how do you stop redevelopment once it comes in? It's been here 4 years.
Well, what we try to do is inform people, because you can't take the NIMBY approach. It's just not a deep enough argument. You can't say we don't want that there. You have to look at the principle of how these projects are being financed and what they're really bringing in. And I think it takes a lot of time and patience to educate people as to what's really happening.
Yeah.
And you can go to the Freedom 21 website, and a good place to start is the Understanding Sustainable Development, a Guide for Public Officials. That's kind of a Cliff Notes version of what's going on and kind of how to fight it. And I know there's some stuff that you know about, Joanne, about how these meetings are conducted.
Oh, I went to one, and the guy who is the unelected official, right, of redevelopment, I saw him at the courthouse. He says, oh, are you coming to the next meeting? And I said, no. And he looked at me, and I said, well, I said, you had a facilitator there. And I said, all you did did what, I said, you have an agenda, right? And he says, yeah. And I said, you just manipulated all of us. And he did. It was horrible. It was just absolutely horrible. They already have made their decisions, and they make us play these silly little games about what we would like to see happen.
Right, what would you like to see?
Oh, it was the dialectic.
Exactly.
It was horrible. It was so insulting.
Yeah.
And so what they're doing is, we have lakefront property here. We're on a highway, and to the right of, or I don't know how you say it, south end of the highway is our lake. 100 feet lots, that's all they are. And they're condemning, they're going to buy them all up, and they've already bought tons of them. The other question I had is, I cannot find any transfer tax. In other words, when they buy them, it's like a big secret what they pay for them.
It's getting really hard to trace the money.
And you're saying, well, see, the other, this earlier in the show, you guys had the water.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have a private water company here.
Oh, they're going to come after you.
Oh, they have already. It's unbelievable. We've formed a Lucerne flow to try to take it back to the public, you know, in other words, become a public water, but it is privatized, and it's all the nightmares of, we saw the movie Thirst. So we have redevelopment and the water.
Now,
you know?
Is that flow, does that stand for Friends of Locally Owned Water?
Exactly.
Okay, watch out for that, because...
I did pick up on that somewhere on the agenda, on the Freedom 21. What is that about?
That is controlled at the top. It's sort of similar to your Chamber of Commerce, which seems like a local organization.
Yeah.
But at the top, there's an international Chamber of Commerce. And so people are recruited thinking they're doing the right thing and standing up for what's right. But the group gets hijacked. And in our area, we have a flow group that is working to transfer. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they're working to transfer out of CalAm.
Exactly.
But it doesn't go into the hands of the private people. It goes into local government control.
And I actually emailed that article to the group here in Lucerne, that they need to be very careful what they choose, what format, I don't know how to say it, formation of what kind of water company that they do. Because that's exactly right. Did you write that?
That was a voluntary collective effort.
Yeah, it was excellent. It was excellent because, I go, there you go. You know, you can't trust anything anymore.
You have to really be very careful.
Yeah.
Don't jump from the frying pan to the fire, because there's often a third choice or fourth choice that's not visible, and that's usually the right way to go.
Well, in my neighborhood, we're part of a private company, and we're getting pressure from both sides of the public water companies to try to take us over. And the bottom line is, you know, the local people have to keep it. You have to work it, because what they try to do is wear you out so that you say, oh, you know, it's too much effort for us to do it. Let's give it to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you got to hang on to it yourselves.
Well, I think the guy that headed up Lucerne Flow, I know he did this, you know, he joined the flow thing, but he really does understand, I think, from the get-go, that we really have to keep it under our control. And LAFCO up here is not going to help us. They are going to fight us. They told us it's going to cost $140,000 for the survey. We have to have a survey and an appraisal. And I told the guy, over the phone floor, I said, I already called the appraiser. I said, it's $6,000. That's the business and the property. And he doesn't believe me. He'll find out that it's true. But what they did is they came to a meeting and scared everybody.
Yeah.
You know, frightened them. And we're a very impoverished area. There's only it's about 3,000 people now. But 50% of people are on disability, social security, you know, fixed incomes. Old.
They're taking advantage of that.
Oh, they are. They'd love to deposit town down and get rid of everyone that's poor here.
Do you have nonprofit groups and foundations pouring money in?
No.
Only coming from your city.
No, we don't have anybody helping us right now.
Well, I mean, not in a good way. Funding.
Give me an example of what?
Well, like down here, we have the Packard Foundation that funds a lot of nonprofits who then go out and.
You know, I don't think we do.
No.
So yeah, but it's a very cookie county.
Okay.
There's only about 62,000 people in the whole county. It's a big county. And it's old.
I bet LIFCO is getting some foundation money.
Yeah, all estate money, tax money. There's so much money in this business, and people think, oh, you know, it won't happen because our government's broke. Well, they're broke for the things that count, like fixing our roads and our potholes and police and fire protection. But
yeah.
There are billions and billions of dollars for this type
yeah.
of thing.
We're an unincorporated area, so we just have, like, we're under the sheriff's department, and we have volunteer firemen, you know,
well,
that kind of thing.
Your sheriff will stand up and say, you know, stop the feds from coming in, because that's the sheriff.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what we're going to do, but I can, it's like we're, I feel like we're a big experiment, but everything you say about the apartments upstairs and stores downstairs,
mm-hmm.
that is, I have pictures of that. That's mm-hmm. what they want this town to look like.
Right.
It's just, it's unbelievable.
Right, and it's
and
fine if it were a choice, but it's not a choice.
Well, yeah, let me ask you this. Now, we know how much it costs to build something. And at one point, I figured this out at the beginning. I said, they'll never do it because they can't get the rent. Now, we don't live in Santa Cruz, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is a little bit different up here, financially or economically. It's not cost effective.
No.
We've got I have one guy, he went and built a retail place to their specs. Everything's supposed to look like Swiss.
Oh.
Ridiculous. Oh, it's just ridiculous. We have another guy that did, I mean, this is so hokey, and another guy did a restaurant, and he's into it for big dollars, you know, and all to the design, right? And nobody's making any money.
So the government, is it a public-private partnership? Where
no, they gave him a loan,
mm-hmm.
but the loan was on his residence, not on the business. They're smart. So he had to sell his house to pay off that, you know, because he couldn't service the loan.
Well, it's not a straightforward way of doing business when we're dealing with...
No, well, it's not free enterprise.
It's not free enterprise.
No, it's not. Anyway, I think you guys are wonderful.
Well, thanks for calling.
Okay, I'll keep listening.
Great.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
We have Jeannie back on the line there? I think Jeannie's back. Jeannie?
Well, I just had to answer on that flow because that's extremely dangerous. What that is, it's in...
So you have experts all over the country. Thank you.
They have... they're a group of very radical environmentalists, and they're under Public Citizen. I've seen them in action at the international conferences in New York under the United Nations conference.
Public Citizen, Jeannie, is that Ralph Nader?
Yes, it is. And you can actually go into this website, and they have FLO listed there as one of the radical environmental organizations. It's www.wateractivists.org. And basically what FLO is, they're the controlled opposition. They want the local people to buy into the water system. That puts a heavy progressive tax on the private property, and that's what they want. They want the taxes so high that eventually the people can't live in that area. What you need is the private water mutual companies that you have.
Yeah,
like
you know.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that. Thanks, Jeannie. Yeah,
thanks,
right.
Jeannie. It's all about the mutual water company.
Keep your own water.
That's right.
But other things to look for out there are terms, you know, historic preservation. It sounds good. We want to protect and preserve history, but historic preservation is just another way to add layers of control on those properties that have that designation. So,
I'm guessing because mm-hmm. the rule of thumb is, you know, if there's government subsidy or government money or foundation money, it's probably really not a good thing.
Right. I mean, you can even look at the International Baccalaureate Program, and that comes, you know, that's right out of the Soviet Union curriculum and UN curriculum, gets federal funding. Even our private schools are receiving federal funding, and there's always strings attached.
Well, yeah, I mean, like we said before, they always comes packaged
really well. I think of anything that I've learned is that the folks who are forwarding Agenda 21 know how to market and they know how to package.
Right. Yeah, I have an article from on Berlin. This is recently too, 2002, and they turned Berlin into chic. And it didn't matter that the flats were cramped and dark, and both parents worked, and state child care was provided. But these things were marketed in a way that drew people, and they're paying a lot of money to live there. And these are the old Plattenbaus, they're called, panel construction.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, it's like in San Francisco, you know, they're turning warehouses into artist communities, you know, with government subsidy, so.
And I bet ultimately those artists will be told perhaps what they can perform. I know that a local theater group who received foundation money from was told what he could direct and what he couldn't direct. So there's always a constraint.
Oh, and again, the really amazing thing, even in the arts, mm-hmm. right? Okay, well, if you have an environmental theme and, you know, you have the right theme, then you can go ahead and do that.
Exactly. It's mind control, subtle mind control going on from all angles. But some other buzzwords, Roy, would be to preserve or to protect. Action, do you hear that word a lot, action?
Mm-hmm.
The acronym on the back of our local Agenda 21 document, which again is the plan to control everything we do, ACTION stands for Agenda 21 Community Teamwork in Operation Now. So that's a word to look out for.
And the 21 is very popular.
Yeah, then that stands for the 21st century, but we do see that, like, in the table of contents, there are 12 chapters. That's 21 reversed.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's all over the place.
Well, the 21st education, there's just all those agendas.
Mm-hmm. Sustainable medicine is something to look into. We have good radio programs on that. Traffic calming, that is a very dangerous issue that's being packaged as making streets more bike-friendly and pedestrian-friendly, but I really urge people to look at what's happening in these areas where speed bumps and traffic circles, roundabouts are being put in.
The planters?
Planters, the street furniture. I mean, this is not safe. Our traffic engineers are not designing roads that are safe anymore.
And they make them narrower?
Narrower. And sometimes they're not even physically narrower. It's just the paint, the striping.
Well, and the car lanes are getting narrower, but the bike lanes are getting wider.
Yeah, and I love to bike.
Oh, yeah.
I think we can have it all. We just need to start thinking outside of the box and not just jump into the two choices that are given to us.
Well, thank you for all the work that you do and for a really informative hour. And thank you, everyone, for participating. And remember, check us out, f21sc.net. There's a lot of good stuff out there for you. Be a good American and do your part. Talk to you next week.
Thank you, Roy.